We are in almost, well, halfway, three-fourths of the way done with Numbers 21. We ended in the middle of a chapter last week. I didn't have time to finish. So, Numbers 21, remember, they got at the beginning, God grants them victory where they had suffered defeat 40 years before when God had said, don't go into the land anymore. And they said, just kidding. We're sorry, we'll go into the land. Moses says, don't. They do anyway, and they get trounced, right? So at that same spot, God now grants them victory 40 years later. Then, if you look at that one map, the first map, right? This one, where they go down and around. Because, right, they ask Edom if they could go through. Edom said no, and so they have to go around it because God said they're not, they don't get Edom. Because Edom is Esau's land. Okay, so they don't get Edom, and they complain because they have a long journey. Okay, and so then God sends the serpents, the fiery snakes, to bite them. But how does this generation react differently than the first? Do you remember?
They didn't complain and ask for water.
No, they. Oh, that's later on. Yes, that's later in the chapter. But in this case, they do complain because of the food. Yes, they acknowledge that they sinned. So they do complain, but they acknowledge that they sin and they ask Moses to intercede for them, which is different than before. Moses always just did it on his own accord. Okay? So God tells Moses to make the bronze serpent, put it up on a pole, and if you look at it and believe. Okay? Then from there, it's just a list basically of their journeyings north, okay? On the other side of the Jordan, the east side of the Jordan. Okay? Then we started the beginning of the next section where they defeat the Amorites. So can someone read for me again, chapter 21, verse 21 to 35? So the whole rest of the chapter.
As far as Medeba. So Israel lived in the Amorites' land. After Moses sent spies to Jazer, Israel captured its villages and drove out the Amorites who were there. Then they turned and went up the road to Bashan. The Og king of Bashan came out against them with his whole army to do battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have handed him over to you along with his whole army and his land. Do to him as you did to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon. So they struck him, his sons, and his whole army until no one was left, and they took possession of the land.
Okay, so last week, thank you, we did the first section, verses 21 to 26, okay, where Israel defeats the Amorites. And if you look at this second map, 3-3 at the top, okay, the Arnon River is at the very south, at the very bottom of your map. Okay, the Jabbok River is kind of halfway up. Okay, right above the word Gilead. Okay, so that is the territory that they conquer from the Amorites. And do you see the green Ammon in the east, right? So they conquer from the Jabbok, to the Arnon, but then not farther east, really, than the blue line, and their border on the west would have been the Jordan River. Okay, so that's what the Amorites had, and that's what they conquer. The Ammonites are descendants of, do you remember? Lot. So they don't get the Ammonite land. They don't get land of anything, anybody that is related to them. So the Edomites are from Esau. They don't get that land. The Moabites are from Lot. They don't get that land. The Ammonites are from Lot as well. You know, white, right? One from each daughter. So they don't get that land. But the Amorites, they do. They conquer that land. Okay.
I have a question about
yes.
the King's Highway.
Yes. Yes.
Stretch.
Yes.
But at this time period in history, there were lots of little areas, that, and each little area had their own king.
Yes.
So this King's Highway, do you know anything about how it was the King's Highway that it was this big? It wasn't like one King's Highway. It was just...
Oh, what? Where the name came from? No, I have no idea.
I thought Todd said that it was, when we were in Israel, that it was named the King's Highway for multiple.
I mean, it was a major trade route, so it wasn't, I don't think it was like one king owned the whole thing. It was a trade route that traded between kingdoms.
Or it wasn't one king that created it.
Yeah.
Made it.
Yeah, I don't know why it was called that, but.
The route that was used by so many, and there was different kings. That's what he said.
Okay,
I think
sense.
It's in my notes.
That's cool. Makes sense.
Yeah, good question. All right, so Israel conquers Sihon, okay? And they take all the land. Then in verses 27 to 31, we get this poem, okay? It says, therefore, those who use Proverbs say, come to Heshbon, let it be built. So let the city of Sihon be established, for a fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame from the town of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab, the dominant heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, O Moab! You are ruined, O people of Chemosh. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon. Okay, so verses 27 to 29, we think, is an Amorite song, right? Because it is praising Sihon, the king that the Israelites just conquered. Right? And it is saying that Sihon took this land from the Moabites. Well, when Israel fought the Amorites, the Moabites had nothing to do with it, right? They're south of the Arnon River. Okay? So the traditional Jewish interpretation is that this song, verses 27 to 29, is a Amorite song, praising Sihon for conquering the Moabites. Right? Verse 29, woe to you, O Moab, you are ruined, O people of Chemosh. Chemosh is their god, the Moabite god. Okay, he has given his sons as fugitives, being the god. Chemosh has given his sons, the Amorites, or the Moabites, as fugitives, and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon. Okay, so then you get verse 30, but we, being Israel, have cast them down. Heshbon is ruined as far as Dibon, and we have laid waste even to Napha, which reaches to Medeba. So the Jews, the Israelites, took the Amorite song and then they tack on another verse, right? Saying, hey, look, the Amorites, they defeated the Moabites and they thought that they were all so powerful. Then what did we do? Abigail. We came in and we... No, that's all right. Then the Israelites came in and they defeated the Amorites, right? So the Amorites defeated the Moabites, and then the Israelites came in and defeated the Amorites. So that makes Israel the top dog, right? Because the assumption is if they can defeat the Amorites and the Amorites defeat the Moabites, then Israel could defeat the Moabites as well. No problem. Okay? Does that make sense? What's interesting is later on in Scripture, this event is referred to. If you go to Judges, it's kind of a long section, but... And I actually preached a message on this section at my women's Bible study in California. I was assigned Jephthah when we went through Judges. not the vow part, thankfully, the beginning part. Can someone read for me Judges 11, 12 to 28? Kind of a big section, but Judges 11, 12 to 28.
Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon, saying, "What is between you and me that you have come to me to fight against my land?" The king of the sons of Ammon said to the messengers of Jephthah, "Because Israel took away my land when they came up from Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan, therefore return them peaceably now." But Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the sons of Ammon, and they said to him, "Thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the sons of Ammon. For when they came up from Egypt, and Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, 'Please let us pass through your land.' But the king of Edom would not listen. And they also sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. So Israel remained at Kadesh. Then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon, and they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon, and Israel said to him, 'Please let us pass through your land to our place.' But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory, so Sihon gathered all his people and camped in Jahaz and fought with Israel. The Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. So they possessed all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and from the wilderness as far as the Jordan. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we will possess it. Now are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel, or did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aram and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon." But the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jacob had sent him.
Okay, so what's happening here is this is the time of the judges. There is no king in Israel. The Ammonites are going to attack the Israelites that are living in this area between the Arnon and the Jabbok River, okay? Because Reuben will eventually inherit that land, okay? And Ammon says, "You stole our land from us. Give it back. It's ours." And so then Jephthah gives them a history lesson, and he says, "Oh, no, it's not. We won it fair and square from the Amorites." And he's referring back to this, to Numbers 21. And he gives them the exact same history, saying, "You never owned this land. We won it from Sihon, the king of the Amorites. And when you conquer a land, you get it. And we conquered this land fair and square. So back off. It's ours." Okay. Now the Ammonites don't listen to him. But it's interesting that, and it says, "We've lived here 300 years and you've done nothing about it." So it's at least been 300 years from Numbers 21 to Judges 11. Okay, so they had been, I mean, and think about it. America's not even 300 years old yet. The United States is not 300 years old yet. So that's a long time to live in the land, you know, and not have anyone come and challenge you for it. And then they say, "Hey, it's ours. Give it back to us." Well, we're not going to roll over, right? They're not going to roll over. And so, but it's interesting that Jephthah knows his history. Right.
Or governmental leadership in the country of any kind.
Yep.
For him to have known the word.
Right. Right.
And the history.
And he relates it very accurately. What he says is very close to Numbers 21. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So back to Numbers 21. Verse 27. This is a call to rebuild Heshbon. that was destroyed when the Amorites took it from Moab. Okay, so there was a battle between the Amorites and the Moabites, and Heshbon gets destroyed in the process. But the Amorites, remember this is an Amorite song, say, hey, let's build it up again so it can be the capital city of Sihon. Verse 28, the fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame from the town of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab, the dominant heights of the Arnon. Okay, so basically, this is poetic language to see, say, the fire, you know, consumed Heshbon is going to destroy all of the Moabites, at least north of the Arnon River. Okay, then verse 29 kind of mocks the Moabite god, right? It looks like Sihon captured a lot of the young people, the Moabite young people, right? He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to the Amorite king. So the point is, Chemosh was unable to protect these young people. And you have to remember that back then, the view of war was that whoever won, the war wasn't fought just on a human level. It was also fought on a spiritual level. So when the Moabites and the Edomites, no, sorry, the Amorites and the Moabites fought each other, the Moabite god and the Amorite god were also fighting each other. That's what they thought. And so when the Amorites won, that means that the Amorites conquered the Moabite god. Okay, so Chemosh was conquered by the Amorite god. And that's what this verse means, right? You are ruined, O people of Chemosh. Your God is not able to protect you. Okay? What's interesting is someone read for me 1 Kings 11, verse 7. 1 Kings 11, verse 7. Okay, so who builds a temple for Chemosh and Molech? Solomon. Solomon built the temple of God, of Yahweh. Right? But what's happened by this point in Solomon's life? Yes, all his wives have led him astray. His 300 wives and his 700 concubines. No, yeah, no. Whichever way it goes. I don't remember. I can't ever remember which way it goes. 700 wives or 300 wives and 700 concubines or 300 concubines. Whatever. All of them. Bad news. So he builds a temple to Chemosh and Molech. If you remember, Molech is the god that you offer your babies to, sacrifice your babies to. And it's east of Jerusalem. So it's not very far from the temple of God. So this is the God which in chapter 21 and 22, is being defeated. And now hundreds of years later during the Solomon's reign, Israel is now worshiping this God as well, which is sad. Okay. Numbers 21 verse 30, but we have cast them down. This is Israel speaking. Israel triumphs over all. Okay. They have destroyed the one that was so proud of his destruction. So this song is praising Sihon, and Israel is saying, ha ha, right? He was so proud of all of that he did, and now he's gone. He's dead, and his land is now ours. Okay? Israel now dwells in the land, verse 31. Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. Okay, so it's a complete conquest. But remember, did Israel pick this fight? Did they set out to defeat the Amorites? Was that their goal? Why did they fight? Yes, they just want to cross. They asked the Amorites the same thing that they asked Edom. Hey, just let us cross through your land. We just want to get to the promised land. We won't eat any of your food. We won't drink any of your water. We'll pay for it if we do, as in Deuteronomy. And what does Sihon do?
He grabs his horses and goes down.
Yeah, and he attacks them. It says, verse 23, he fought against Israel, right? So they fight and defeat, not because that was their goal, but because they were attacked. Okay? Verse 32, Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. Then they turned up and went by the way of Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, went out with all his people for battle at Edrei. Okay, so Israel continues to conquer Transjordan. This wasn't necessarily their plan, but this is what happens, okay? So they defeat the Amorites at Jazer, and then they continue north. If you look at that 3-3 map, okay, and kind of the middle right, there's the red box that says Jazer with a question mark, Jazer. Okay, we don't know where a lot of these places are for sure, okay? But that's where they think. And then they've continued north, and Edrei is at the top with the number 2 below it, also in a red box, okay? So that's where we think they are. And then to get a whole view of Israel, if you look at this map, the really colorful one, okay, you can see Edrei is the white dot in the middle of the purplish area. Do you see it east of the Sea of Galilee? Can you see that? Okay, so here you also have the Jabbok River and the Arnon River, okay, and which is purple because this is where Reuben is going to be. Okay, but not Ammon. You see Ammon, they don't get any of the area of the Ammonites, but so they're continuing up north to east of the Sea of Galilee. There's when they divvy up the land in Joshua, it lists a ton of cities that each tribe gets, and so some of those cities we know where they are, and so then they can. And it's not exact. I mean, I don't know if anyone would swear their life by these boundary lines, but as close as we know from what we know about scripture and what we know about archaeology, then they come up with these maps. Mm-hmm.
Are you asking for the countries, the different countries, or the different...
There's a little line right here.
Yeah, how do they know that that's exact?
Okay. Sometimes they use natural boundaries a lot. Right. Like rivers or mountain ranges or like something that was kind of like...
We can't cross this because we can't cross this because we're into the...
Someone else's land, yeah.
They didn't always have that, but they often would use that kind of...
Right.
Might have a wall around it or maybe a
not their territory. They might their field or vineyard or something, but that would be too big for like their territory. But yeah, also it's, I mean, and then we are given some, like this brook of Egypt, it was, God said, was to be the southern border of Israel, right, coming out of the Mediterranean Sea. And Israel was to be all the way up through the Euphrates River, which is at the very top here. The green goes all the way up. Okay. Which they don't even come close to having all that today.
Now, the Amorites had land. I thought you said at one point they couldn't own land. The Amorites.
No. They... No, I'm not sure what you're referring to, but the Amorites owned between the Arnon River and the Jabbok River here. Okay? And actually, Og, king of Bashan, he's an Amorite as well. So that's, they're going to get north as well. So they owned land. The Israelites were allowed to defeat them because they were not relatives. Is that what you're asking? I'm not sure if that's what, because... God says specifically, you're not allowed to take Edom, you're not allowed to take Moab, and you're not allowed to take Ammon. They're not allowed to conquer those lands because they are relatives.
Would you be thinking perhaps of Levi that wasn't given any land, the tribe of Levi?
I heard you mention that.
Mention what? That Levi couldn't have land?
Well, somebody couldn't have land.
Levi. The Levites were not given by God any special land. Area.
They got cities.
Lot didn't get any land either.
Well, Lot is the Moabites and the Ammonites. the Moabites and the Ammonites are the sons of Lot by his daughters, if you remember that horrendous story, after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? His daughters think the world's at the end, and there's no men left to have babies with, so there's only dad. So then they have Moab and Ammon. And so that's why God tells the Israelites they're not allowed to conquer those lands, because those are lands of relatives. Now, just like in families, you don't always get along. It's not like the Israelites got along with the Edomites, the Moabites, and the Ammonites very well. But they were not to conquer those lands because God had given those lands to them. Esau. So Jacob and Esau. Did I answer your question, Helen, or no? Kind of. Ask again if I didn't. Okay. I mean, it's hard to keep them all straight. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I've heard mosquito bites. Yeah. Oh, the Amorites, the Hittites, the mosquito bites. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so they continue north to Bashan. Og, king of Bashan, is another Amorite king. Okay, so back then, they weren't so united as nations like we are today, where you might have one ruler over the whole thing. You would have more tribal chieftains that would be over a certain area, right? But there could be another Amorite king. Okay, so Sihon was the Amorite king that controlled between the Jabbok and the Arnon River, so this chunk of land. Og, the king of Bashan, is the Amorite king that is in charge of the northern portion. Okay. All right, can we turn to Deuteronomy? Can someone read for me Deuteronomy 3, verse 1 to 11?
So the Lord our God delivered Og also, king of Bashan, with all his people into our hand, and we smote them until no survivor was left. We captured all these cities at that time. There was not a city which we did not take from them. 60 cities, all the region of Argob, and the kingdom of Og in Bashan. All these were cities fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides a great many unwalled towns. We utterly destroyed them, as we did to Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. But all the animals and the spoil of the cities we took as our booty. Thus we took the land at that time from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, from the valley of Arnon to Mount Hermon. Sidonians call Hermon Sirihon, and the Amorites call it Seir. All the cities of the plateau and all Gilead and all Bashan, as far as Saleka and Endre, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of Rapham. Behold, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. It is in Reba of the city's Ammon. Its length was 9 cubits and its width 4 cubits by ordinary cubits.
Okay, so we get more details here about this conquest. In Numbers, it just says that they fight him. Og goes out with all his people for battle. And Deuteronomy seems to make it more clear that Israel is attacked, right? But God, as they go up, God has already told Israel, you're going to fight and you're going to win, okay, as they go north. So Og shows up in full military array and Israel conquers them. Now, it's interesting. The Amorites are listed in the lists when God says you are going into the land of the Hittites, and the Amorites are one of those listed. So the Amorites are Canaanites that are to be conquered by Israel. The thing is, Israel is not technically even in the promised land yet, but God is allowing them battles to win.
What was that again? Deuteronomy
3:1-11.
Oh, I just got to know why they got to talking all this dead stuff.
Because it's so huge.
I have a great note in my Bible about that. Well, over here.
giant race that inhabited Palestine, C220, his iron bedstead has been understood as an iron-trimmed stone coffin, or an iron-decorated couch to be placed in his tomb, or as a monument made of basalt, an iron-bearing rock. In any case, it was 13.5 feet, like 6 feet, indicating how huge Og was.
Yeah, that's why.
He was a giant.
Right, and so remember, why did the Israelites not want to go into Canaan in the first place? Because there are giants in the land. So what's happening? God is building up their confidence, right, to trust him. He is being very gracious, and with this second generation who is going to enter the land, he is granting them victories in what technically isn't even the land that God promised them, right? And they are even conquering giants who have really big beds, whether it's a tomb or a bed he slept in. Regardless, it's huge. Yeah. Okay. In Judges 13:29-31, we don't have to read it, but this land that they conquer from Og, king of Bashan, is given to Manasseh. Okay. So the half tribe of Manasseh gets to live here.
What was that reference?
Judges 13:29-31. Back to Numbers 21, verse 34. But the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand and all his people in his land, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon. So this is repeat of what we've read in Deuteronomy 3. But it's interesting that God says, do not fear, right? I have given him into your hand. Can someone read for me chapter 14, verse 9 of Numbers? Okay, so this is what Joshua and Caleb are saying to the people when they're trying to convince them to go into the land the first time, right? So they're saying, don't fear the people, don't fear the people. Well, now this is the second generation in Numbers 21, and God is saying, do not fear, okay? He's saying the same things that Caleb and Joshua said to the people, and God is reminding this generation that they need to trust him and not fear the people. Right? And if they are going to fear the people, they're going to just repeat the rebellion of chapter 14, which they don't do, but, you know, God is giving them a second chance. Okay. Verse 35, so they killed him, being Og, king of Bashan, and his sons and all his people until there was no remnant left him, and they possessed his land. Okay. So Israel does not fear. Israel obeys and fights Og, king of Bashan, and God grants them victory. Okay? God is giving them a taste of what it is like, what it will be like to conquer the promised land. If they obey and they do what he says, they will get victory after victory after victory, because God has promised that that's what's going to happen. Okay? God is shaping them into who he wants them to be. Right? These battles, Transjordan, are going to help them be confident when they actually enter the land that God promised them to conquer that. Okay? Now, what's interesting is these specific two victories are remembered throughout Scripture. Let's go to Joshua. Can someone read for me Joshua 2:10? This is Rahab, and she is talking to the spies who have come to spy out Jericho. And she references three events, right? The crossing of the Red Sea, right, when Egyptian army was destroyed, and then these two battles, Og, king of Bashan, and Sihon, okay? And verse 11, when we heard it, our hearts melted, right? It was these battles that caused the people of Jericho to really fear the Israelites. Okay. We won't turn there, but Nehemiah 9:22. It's a prayer recounting all that God has done for Israel, and these two victories are recounted. And then also Psalm 135, verse 8 to 11. It's again listed in the great works of God. So that's Nehemiah 9:22 and Psalm 135, verse 8 to 11. Okay, questions, chapter 21.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Ago,
yes.
Got that northern area.
Yes.
That was the Amorites.
Yes.
The Og area.
Yes.
Now, did you also mention a little bit before that that Reuben got the southern area?
Yes.
Of the Sihon area?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, and then there's another Gad gets somewhere in between there, I think. Gilead area, Gad gets. Because there's 2.5 tribes on Transjordan. Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh. Any, yes. Yes, I believe so. Any other questions? Okay. Then we enter chapter 22. This is a new section. This is our good friend Balaam. Okay, and hopefully everyone is at least somewhat familiar with Balaam. I feel like that anytime there's an animal in the Bible, we decide it's a child story. Right? Noah and the Ark, Jonah and the whale, right? Balaam and the talking donkey. Yeah, there's a lot more than just the cute animals part of the story. Okay, so this is chapter 22 is the starts of the Balaam oracles. Okay, so this is going to go 22 to 24 and really through 25. Okay, Balaam, we find out, is responsible for chapter 25 as well. So this is a good chunk of Balaam. Balaam is a pagan divination expert. Abner calls him the God Whisperer. Okay, just like you have the dog whisperer, whatever, you can get the dogs to do what you want. Balaam was a prophet diviner who built a reputation for being able to get the gods to do what he wanted them to do. That was his job. Okay? God is going to use Balaam against his will to reveal God's agenda to the nations. This is going to be the whole point. God is going to talk directly to the nation, to the nations, and explain his purpose for Israel. Because Balaam is worldwide famous, everyone's going to hear about what happens here in Numbers 22 to 24.
So he's a false prophet.
Yes. 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 Yes, exactly. And we're gonna see how that Balaam kind of goes along kicking and screaming. Okay. So God still has a great plan for Israel, even though she is rebellious. Okay, right? Israel doesn't have a great track record up to this point, and she's not going to continue to have a great track record. But God is still going to bless her. Okay? So I said Balaam is famous. How do we know that? We actually have a text. It's called the Deir-Ilah text, D-E-I-R, if you want to spell it, D-E-I-R-A-I-L-A. If you care. Okay. They're different. It's a fragment that they've discovered in Jordan, and it specifically mentions Balaam, son of Beor, as the seer of the gods, prophet of the gods. And Balaam, son of Beor, and that's exactly how he's listed in the Bible in verse 5. He sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor. Okay.
What was his name?
Seer of the gods. So prophet, seer is just another word for prophet, but seer of the gods. Okay. And in the text, it says, you know, he had a dream of some coming disaster. I don't remember specifically, but he is called the seer of the gods. Okay. Now, how should we interpret Balaam? If you just read chapter 22, it will leave you a little confused on what to think about Balaam. Okay? Because it seems like he obeys God and he listens and he does what God says. Okay? If you just read through it. Just chapter 22. Because the messengers come to him. God says, no, you can't curse Israel. Balaam says, I can't go with you. So you're like, oh, good for you, Balaam. Right? And then when Balaam actually does go, right, God says, bless Israel, and Balaam blesses Israel. Okay? But we have to take scripture as a whole. Okay? And we cannot get his character wrong. Also, verse 18, if you look at verse 18, it says, bottom of it, he says, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. And the word he uses for Lord is what?
Yahweh.
Yahweh. He uses the personal name of God, and he calls him my God. All right? So, if you just read it, you're like, wow, maybe Balaam was a believer. Okay? Maybe God really was his God. He uses the personal name of God, Yahweh, and he calls him my God. Okay? But we cannot be deceived by Balaam. All right? He, we're going to learn, is an unwilling participant. He blesses Israel because God literally gives him no choice. Okay? It's do this or die is basically what it comes down to.
Balaam is also a reference
to Revelation. Yes, and we will get there. That's all right. So we're going to look at other passages that talk about Balaam besides just here in Numbers 22. So first, can someone read for me Numbers 31, verse 8 to 16?
31.
Numbers 31, verse 8 to 16. This is talking about Israel, what they've done.
Of Beor with the sword. The sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones and all their cattle and all their flocks and all their goods they plundered. Then they burned all their cities where they lived and all their camps with fire. They took all the spoil and all the prey, both of man and of beast. They brought the captives and the prey and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the congregation of the sons of Israel to the camp at the plains of Moab, which are by the Jordan opposite Jericho. Moses and Eleazar, a priest, and all the leaders of the congregation went out to meet them outside the camp. Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the captains of thousands, and the captains of hundreds, who had come from service in the war. And Moses said to them, have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Beor, so the plague was among the congregation of the Lord.
Okay, so we get to chapter 31, and Israel kills Balaam. Okay? Then in this war against Midian. Now, this story is going to be the Moabites and the Midianites team up together to hire Balaam to curse Israel. Okay, that's what they want him to do. God says, you can't do that because you can't curse my people, so you're going to bless them instead, right? The king of Moab gets really angry at Balaam because all he does is keep blessing Israel. We find out in this passage that Balaam is killed, which tells us something. Israel kills him. And two, verse 16, Moses is mad because when they fight Midian, what does the army do? They spare who? The women. They spare the women. They don't kill the women. That makes Moses mad. Why? Have you spared? Behold, these, being the women, caused the sons of Israel, skip the next phrase, to trespass against the Lord. If you go to chapter 25.
Through the counsel of Balaam.
Through the counsel of Balaam. Chapter 25. Right after the oracles of Balaam, right? Balaam is done blessing Israel. Chapter 25, verse 1, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. Verse 6, behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman. Okay? So, in chapter 25, we get the story of these Moabite women and these Midianite women. They come and they seduce the sons of Israel and they lead them into idolatry. Okay? Verse 31, whose idea was it? I mean, chapter 31, whose idea was it? It was Balaam's. So Balaam comes, he blesses Israel because God basically says, you have no choice, you have to bless Israel, right? He blesses Israel. Balak, the king of Moab's really mad because he brought him there to curse Israel. So Balaam, we find out later, it doesn't say it in verse 24, in chapter 24 or 25, but in chapter 31, we find out that Balaam was like, okay, Balak, I can't get God to go turn against his people, but maybe I can get the people of Israel to turn against their God. This is how we're going to do it. We're going to send the women out and they're going to lead the men astray. It was Balaam's idea that caused chapter 25, the sin of Peor, where they, the Midianite women and the Moabite women, come and lead the men astray. Make sense? Questions?
Clear as mud.
Clear as mud. Okay, what's... Okay.
You know, little off,
yep.
But I think I've got it.
Okay. So what you need to know is that Balaam is used by God to bless Israel, but he doesn't want to. His whole job is getting the gods to do what he wants them to do. He figures out, I can't manipulate Yahweh. So if I can't do that, what's my other option? Maybe I can get the people to turn against their God. And he comes up with this brilliant idea of using the women of Moab and the women of Midian to get the Israelites to turn against their God instead of getting the God to turn against his people.
Did you also say that it was his idea in the battle, save the women, keep the women?
No, oh. That wasn't his idea. His idea is chapter 25. Okay. Moses is just mad at Israel when they go and defeat Midian. And they actually kill Balaam, he's mad that they didn't kill the women. And he's saying, why did you spare these women? It was these women, through the counsel of Balaam, that led you astray. Why in the world did you leave them alive? Balaam's dead by this point.
Not those exact women. See, I've been chronology confused. It wasn't those exact women that were not killed in chapter 31.
Right.
It was similar women.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Exactly. Any other questions? All right. Let's go to Deuteronomy 23. Can someone read for me verses 3 to 5? Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 5.
Nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you.
Okay, so here Balaam is not painted in a good light. He's hired to curse them, and only because of God does the curse turn into a blessing. Okay, 2 Peter, way into the New Testament. 2 Peter 2, 15 and 16. Second Peter 2, 15 and 16. Okay, and this is talking about false teachers. Peter is describing false teachers, false prophets.
Forsaking the right way, they have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received a rebuke for his own transgression for a mute donkey, speaking with the voice of a man, restrain the madness of the prophet.
Okay, so Peter tells us, because see, in chapter 22 of Numbers, it's not so clear what Balaam's motives are. Okay, it just tells us what happens. It doesn't tell us really what he's thinking. Peter says Balaam wanted the money. Balak promised him a lot of money and a lot of honor, right? Balaam really wants to go and curse Israel because this is going to be a good gig. He's going to get a lot of money from this, right? That is not made super clear in Numbers 22, so you're left kind of wondering, is Balaam a good guy or is Balaam a bad guy? I don't really know. Well, 2 Peter lumps him, Balaam, with the false prophets, and he's making the connection that men come into the church and they just want the money, right? And they just want to do it for the fame, and they are in following the way of Balaam, right? And then it talks about how even his donkey was smarter than him, okay? Than the prophet, than Balaam. Okay, Jude, verse 11. There's only one chapter. Jude, verse 11. Jude 11.
Woe to them, for they have traveled in the way of Cain, have abandoned themselves in the ear of Balaam for profit, and have perished in Korah's rebellion.
Okay, so see, when you read the New Testament, you got to know your Old Testament, or it doesn't make any sense. Again, false prophets is what Jude is about. Woe to them, right? Gone the way of Cain. Not a good guy, right? First murderer in the Bible. And for pay, they have rushed headlong into the era of Balaam, right? They're more concerned about money than about the truth. Okay, last one, last reference, Revelation 2, verse 14. This is the letter to the Ephesians, to Ephesus. Revelation 2, 14.
You have there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols and commit acts of immorality.
Okay, so here we get more detail. After Balaam is done blessing Israel, because God literally forces him to, he tells Balak, I have a different idea. I can't get their God to turn against them, so what are we going to do? We're going to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and commit acts of immorality with these beautiful women, the Moabite and the Midianite women. Okay, so in Revelation, it also tells us that it was Balaam's idea for chapter 25 of Numbers. Okay, so we cannot go into this thinking that Balaam is a good guy, because if you just read it without a lot of previous knowledge, you might come to that conclusion. Okay, but we got to take scripture as a whole. Question? Okay, so the funny thing about this story, back to Numbers 22, right? Okay, Balaam is a God whisperer. His job is to get gods to do what he wants them to do, okay? But the funny thing in this story, the ironic thing, is that his donkey is more spiritually astute than he is, okay? His donkey is more spiritually observant, okay? God is in charge, and when everyone in the story is a fool, who can God use? The donkey. Okay, the donkey is the smartest one in this story of chapter 22. Okay, God ultimately will accomplish his will by whatever means or agency necessary. He can use anyone. Okay, in chapter 22, Balaam is going to have three encounters with God. And then in chapters 23 and 24, he's going to bless Israel three different times. Okay, so in his three encounters with God, the first two times he seeks out God. The third time, which is the donkey story, God just shows up. Okay, in his blessings, God tells him, in his blessings that are supposed to be cursings, the first two times, Balaam seeks out God where he offers sacrifices. The third time, God just shows up. And Balaam just starts talking, even though Balak says, stop, stop! And Balaam has to keep going because God told him to, because he has to. Okay? So the oracles of Balaam are going to emphasize the relationship that God has with Israel and confirm the Abrahamic covenant. Do we remember the things that were listed in the Abrahamic covenant? Land, seed, and blessing. So that's what these oracles are going to be about. God is finally going to bring about the land blessing, right? And they've already exponentially increased in number, right? And, right, they are going to be a blessing to the nations. And God is telling, through Balaam, he is showing the nations that Israel will be a blessing to the nations. Okay? So, even though Balaam is technically a bad guy, right, we need to listen to what he says, because we're going to find out he can't say anything except what God wants him to say. And so, really, his words are going to be God's words, so we need to focus on what his words are, because God made it so that he couldn't say anything else. Questions? That's our intro. Yes, in what's recorded, not every time.
He was a God whisperer. He was known for just saying stuff and
right.
Taking it and whatever.
Right, yes, exactly. In this case, in what is recorded in Scripture, what he said are the very words of God, because God made it that way. Okay? All right, so let's get started. Can someone read for me verse 1 to 4? Okay, sorry, I meant through 14.
Okay. He sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, at Pethor, which is by the Euphrates in the land of his people. Balak said to him, "Look, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the surface of the land and are living right across from me. Please come and put a curse on these people for me, because they are more powerful than I am. I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that those you bless are blessed and those you curse are cursed." The elders of Moab and Midian departed with beasts of divination in their hands. They came to Balaam and reported Balak's words to him. He said to them, "Spend the night here, and I will give you the answer the Lord tells me." So the officials of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God came to Balaam and asked, "Who are these men with you?" Balaam replied to God, "Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent this message to me. Look, a people has come out of Egypt, and they covered the surface of the land. Now come and put a curse on them for me. I may be able to fight against them and drive them away." Then God said to Balaam, "You are not to go with them. You are not to curse this people, for they are blessed." So Balaam got up the next morning and said to Balak's officials, "Go back to your land, because the Lord has refused to let me go with you." The officials of Moab arose, returned to Balak, and reported, "Balaam refused to come with us."
Okay, so this is the first encounter with God for Balaam. Verse 1, sons of Israel journeyed, camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan opposite Jericho. Okay, so if you look at 3:3, okay, right about where it says Amorites, King Sihon, okay, that's where they were camped. If you look across the Jordan River, you can see Jericho, just north of Gilgal. Does everyone see Jericho? Okay, so they're camped across the river from Jericho. And do you see where it says Baal Peor with the question mark? Just below Amorites, King Sihon, it says Baal Peor with a question mark. That's where our best guess is of chapter 25, where chapter 25 takes place. So, not this chapter. We're in chapter 22. So they're just camped in this area. Okay, and they're going to stay here until Joshua. So the rest of Numbers and Deuteronomy take place right here. Okay? So if you remember, chapter 21 leaves them up here at the north in Edrei, Og, king of Bashan. So after they conquer that, they journey back south again, right? Because remember, now this is all their land. They control it all the cities. Okay? And so now they are camped here. Okay, and they're going to be here the rest of Numbers, the rest of Deuteronomy. And then they're going to cross the river into Jordan in Joshua, and into Israel, into Canaan in Joshua. Okay. Okay, verse 2. Balak, son of Zippor. Okay, first, he's only introduced as son of Zippor. We don't even know who this guy is until verse 4. Okay, verse 4 tells us that he is the king of Moab. At the beginning, we don't know that. Okay. Israel has gone around Edom and around Moab. If you looked at that first map I gave you, right? They have to journey all the way south around Edom, then they don't go through Moab. Okay, if we go to Deuteronomy 2, can someone read for me Deuteronomy 2, verse 9? Deuteronomy 2, verse 9. Okay, so God specifically told the Israelites, you can't have any of Moab. Don't go to war with them. So they journey around. Now, Balak, the son, the king of Moab, he's scared half to death. Okay? He does not know that God has told Israel that they are to have nothing, they're not to fight with them, and they are not to conquer their land. Okay? Because it says, verse 2, he saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And remember, who had conquered the Moabites? The Amorites. And now the Israelites conquered the Amorites, so now the Moabites are afraid. I know it's a lot of ites, okay? But Moab is afraid because the people who conquered them have now been conquered, and they're afraid that they're next on Israel's list. They don't know that God told Israel specifically, don't fight with the Moabites. Okay, so really, the Moabites have nothing to fear from Israel. Balak should have no reason to fear Israel because they're not after him or his land. He doesn't know that, so he's afraid. Okay? When it says in verse 2 that he saw all that Israel had done, right? That word saw is not just to visually see, but to see with understanding. Have a clear comprehension of the matters at hand. Okay, this is the same word, I think, that is used when Aaron's rod buds and they bring all the rods out of the Holy of Holies and Israel sees, right? They understand. We don't get to be priests. Only Aaron gets to be a high priest. Okay, same idea. So he thinks Israel is a threat to him because he's seen and understand all that happens, all that has happened. Their God has conquered the god of the Amorites who had conquered his god. Okay. Then verse 3 says, so Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous, and Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. So it's not just Balak the king. All of Moab is in great fear and dread. They think they're going to end up like the Amorites, which means totally destroyed. Verse 4, Moab said to the elders of Midian, okay, Balak is so worried that he enlists help from the Midianites, which is another people group. Do we remember whose wife was a Midianite? No. Moses, Zipporah. Where did Moses flee when he flees from Egypt? To Midian. Okay, these are the Midianites. And Zipporah is a Midianite. Now, we don't know, remember we talked about when Miriam has a complaint against Moses' wife that we're not, and it says she was something else. I can't remember now off the top of my head. Does anyone remember? It says, she was Cushite. Yes, it says she was a Cushite, okay? It is possible, we don't know, it's possible that Zipporah had died. One of the possibilities is Zipporah had died and that Moses had gotten another wife and it's just not recorded. Or there is one passage in scripture that links Cush and Midian, so they could be the same thing, but we're not 100% sure. But Moses had fled to Midian after Egypt. His wife was a Midianite. These are the same people that now Balak seeks help from. Okay. The Midianites help him all the way through chapter 25. Okay? So they are, he counsels with them here. They're part of the groups that are sent to Balaam to ask him to come. And the women are part of the women that try to lead, that successfully lead the sons of Israel astray in chapter 25. And that is why in chapter 31, Midian gets wiped out. Okay, because, okay, Abigail. That's why, yeah, so they are part of this whole process from beginning to end. Okay, Balak says to the Midianites, behold, a people, verse 4. Now this horde, is what he calls the Israelites, will lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. Okay, so Balak sees that Israel is large and will consume Moab like an ox consumes grass. That's the comparison that he draws. Okay. And it's here in verse 4 that we realize that at the end of verse 4, it says Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. Okay, the word for king in Hebrew can mean he ruled all of Moab, or it could be more of like a tribal chieftain. So maybe a specific area, maybe that area around the Arnon River, right, where Israel was close to. Because like with the Amorites, right, you have Sihon, the king of the Amorites, but you also have Og, and he's also an Amorite king. Okay, so it could be like that where he doesn't necessarily rule the whole thing. We're not sure. Okay. Verse 5. So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him. Okay, so Balak decides he needs divine intervention. He knows that he cannot defeat Israel on his own. Okay, probably even with the help of the Midianites, he doesn't think that he could defeat Israel in all-out battle. Okay, so if I can't win it on a physical level, I'm going to win it on a spiritual level. Okay, if I can convince the God of Israel to turn against Israel and be on my side, then I am guaranteed a win on the physical level. Does that make sense, the way he's thinking? Okay, because remember, back then, battles were always fought on two levels. And whatever the outcome of the physical level was, they assume is the outcome of the spiritual level. So if my army beats your army, that means my God beat your God. So if I can get your God to join my side, then I am assured a win. And that is what Balaam did. This is his job, the God whisperer, to manipulate the gods to do what it was that man wanted him to do for the highest fee, right? That was his job. Okay, so he sends, what?
I feel like God would get mad at him for being manipulative.
Yeah.
If it were real.
Right. Right, but their belief about the gods was that, I mean, kind of like the Greeks and the Romans, they're just superhumans, right? So they can be appeased, they can be manipulated, they can be, you know, if you just do the right things, then you can get the gods to do what you want them to do because they're still pleased. Because the gods need you. Remember, we talked about this before. The gods of that time needed worshippers to feed them, right? They would offer food and sacrifices, and that was literally food for the gods that the gods required to, I guess, stay alive. I don't know what happened if your god died. You know, so the view of gods back then is they are they are able to be manipulated. Okay, and so then this was Balaam's job. He had figured it out how that worked out practically, I have no idea. But this was his job, and he was world famous for it. Okay. Okay. Okay, so it says in verse 5, he sent messengers. Okay, so this is Moabite and Midianite. And they are sending formal diplomatic correspondence to Balaam. It says he lives in Pethor near the river. Your version translated it Euphrates, which is what it refers to. The capital R river refers to the Euphrates River. If you look at this map, the colorful one, the Euphrates is up here at the very top of the map. Moab is down here below the Arnon River. Okay, now I'm not exactly sure where Pethor is on the Euphrates. My geography is terrible. But one commentary said it's approximately 420 miles. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they had to go twice because Balaam says no the first time. Okay, so it would have taken approximately 22 to 25 days to travel 420 miles. So this course, because so they go up, ask him, he says no. So then they have to come back. Balak says, I'm not giving up, go again. So they go up, and then finally he agrees to come, and they go down. So it would take at least probably 4 months. Right? 22 to 25 days to travel one way, and then you have to assume you're at least somewhere for at least a couple of days, right? You don't turn around the next day. No, all this time, Israel is just camped right here. They're just sitting there, right? But Balak's probably sweating bullets thinking that every day, you know, Israel could attack and take over, which God has told them not to, so they're not going to, right? But Balak doesn't know that. But it's just interesting to think, you know, we read it in one chapter and it's like, no, even just getting Balaam there took at least 4 months to get him there.
Where did it say that it could go twice then?
Well, so in verse 14, right, the leaders come back and say Balaam refused. So that's trip number one, right? Then verse 15 says, then Balak again sent leaders. So this is the second time they go. And then in verse 21, so Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab. Okay, so he comes back with them the second time. The first time he does not. Okay. Right, and that's why I started out with, if you just read this chapter, it is confusing on whether Balaam is good or bad.
Because we're reading God, capital G, so you know that it's God.
Right.
Talking to Balaam, it's not somebody else.
Right.
So he's like doing what he says.
Yep. Yep.
In 21, God says, okay, fine, go with these men. So then 21, he gets up.
Yes. Yes, God's angry, and we will get there, not today, because we have 5 minutes. But yes, it is confusing what is happening, and so that's why it's important to have a full understanding of who Balaam is and what other portions of Scripture say, because then it makes Numbers 22 make more sense. Remember, too, Moses wrote this, and he wrote this for the Israelites who lived it. And so they would have known, right? They would have known, even reading Numbers 22, Balaam's not a good guy, right? We killed him in chapter 31, and that was a good thing. And we know what he did. They would have known it, right? We, being total outsiders, we have to do our homework a little bit.
Well, for him to make it all the way into the New Testament, to the end of the New Testament, you know.
Right, even all the way to Revelation. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, to the Ephesians church.
Right. Right, right. And that's the thing, is every other time he's mentioned in Scripture, it's a negative. It is not a positive thing.
Well, and then in Revelation, God doesn't like him. He's gonna,
right.
Anyone who follows his belief,
yeah. Right.
Fight against him.
Right, exactly.
He wasn't good.
No, he was not good.
I don't even know his nationality. Is he an Israelite?
No, nope, he's from Mesopotamia. He's whatever that is that's up there north by the Euphrates River.
Okay, no.
No. Well, it's on the Euphrates River, and this map is the green is the promised land,
right,
that Israel has taken. Israel hasn't even done this yet.
Right, okay.
Because they haven't even crossed into Canaan yet.
So he's definitely not.
No.
Okay.
I mean, he's not a Moabite. He's not an Amorite. He's none of these that are down here. He's whatever it was that's up there, which if my... Okay, we'll see if we can get through these first. Yes, he does have a smart donkey.
Saddled him up on 21. He saddled up that donkey.
He did. Okay, so middle of verse 5 is the start of the message to Balaam. This is what the people say, the messengers say, "Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they are cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me." Okay, so it's interesting that Balak starts his message with Israel's deliverance from Egypt. Okay, these, and I mean, that's where these people came, because they were in Egypt 400 years, and so now they've crept out of Egypt, right? Balaam doesn't say that their God delivered them. He doesn't say that their God decimated Egypt and decimated their army, right? He just says this is where the people are come from. But remember, the Exodus, we called it God's signature move because it is salvation. It is saving his people. And it defines all of Israel's history, and even pagan kings recognize it, right? This is where Egypt, Israel is from. Okay, it says they cover the surface of the land. This is like a locust plague that devours all the resources of the land. That's what Moab is, Balak is concerned about. Verse 6. "Now therefore, please come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Balaam is so famous, Balak believes that his blessings and curses are effective. Okay, and like we've said before, Balak needs some advantage, because he knows just on the battlefield, he's sunk. Okay, so he needs an advantage on the spiritual level to win on the physical level.